Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org. is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Just search for Dog Works Radio there, as well as on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, the whole nine. Search for Dog Works Radio as well. I'm hosting today from up in Nome, Alaska, sitting here at the Aurora Inn and Suites with a ocean view. Right outside my window is the Bering Sea. Quite an interesting place up here, my first time up here. I know Alex has been here a few times for the finish of the race, and we're looking forward to talking a little bit about that. Some very important news today on the Iditarod Trail, and our musher profile tonight is Monica Zappa. So without further ado, calling in from Southern California, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It is going great, Robert. A lot of interesting stuff. It's been kind of as you said to me just off the air, it's been a difficult day for Iditarod fans, for mushers, and for anyone who loves dogs. And we'll get into that in quite a bit of detail. Coming up at the front of the pack right now, Brent Sass, Ali Zirkel, and Dallas Seavey are all camping between Caltag and Unalakleet. They are within 6 miles of each other. Brent in first, Ali is sort of in the middle, and then Dallas is after her. Mitch Seavey and Wade Mars have left Caltag on the way out to Unalakleet, but about 20 miles behind. And we've got the top 10 are pretty much in Caltag. After Wade and Mitch, we've got John Baker, Robert Sorley, Nick Pettit, Pete Kaiser, Noah Burmeister, and then just behind the two of them, Yor Olsom and Jeff King. I'm showing here that Baker just left right before we got on the air, so we've got 6 racers in Caltag resting.
And as we mentioned yesterday, the race is typically a race of thirds, and the front runners there are coming into that last third. Unalakleet is usually what most people will consider the last third of the race, a little more than 300 miles or so to go from there. This is where Dallas likes to, what he calls, unleash the monster. It's where he really puts the pedal to the ground. He trains his dogs for this specific portion of the race, and he usually does very well, blowing past a lot of teams as he goes. But I don't know, Alex, what do you think about Brent up there? He is being, you know, quite stealthy out there on the trail this year, isn't he?
Yeah, and one of the things that Brent has done consistently, except when he's taken his 24 and his 8-hour mandatory rest, is he's blown right through the checkpoints, stopped for a couple of minutes, picked up supplies, picked up his drop bags, and then camped out on the trail. This is something I was talking to our friend Tony Ryder about this earlier, and she referred to it as the Dallas Seavey maneuver, and I said I always think of that as what Jeff King would do. Before we had the trackers on all of the sleds, Jeff King would regularly go through checkpoints, seemingly like he was going to go for hours and hours and hours, and then he would stop and camp 10 or 15 miles away from the checkpoint. So people would come into the checkpoints, would hear, oh, yeah, Jeff just breezed through here, and it looks like he'll go all night. So they would feel like they really had to give chase and would sometimes leave before they were as fully rested as they'd wanted to be because they wanted to make sure that they didn't let him get too far ahead. It's a little bit different with the trackers. there's much more of an awareness of where individuals are. In many of the checkpoints where they do have internet, they have people who come in, mushers who come into the checkpoint would be able to get a read on where someone is, even if they're camped. So it's not quite the advantage that it used to be, but Brent has said that he prefers not being in the checkpoints because they're a little bit too crowded. He likes to just be alone with his dogs as much as possible. So that's what he's been doing. He's got a great-looking dog team. He still has 14 dogs. Allie has 14 dogs. Dallas is down to 10 dogs. When you're on the coast, that's not as big a deal to only have 10, and he will be on the coast soon. So that's not necessarily a problem for him only having 10 dogs, and especially if you have the right 10 dogs and they're very powerful dogs, that can certainly take you all the way up the coast.
And, you know, Alex, weather has not been a factor. I know that they were talking about that with Mitch, Dallas, Allie, and Brent when they said that camping out on the river isn't as precarious as it usually is. There aren't any winds out there. It's not too terribly cold, and they're using that to their advantage, able to camp out on the river versus in the crowded checkpoints.
Yeah. And as we've talked about, you never know, and the weather can change very quickly within, you know, a couple of hours or sometimes a couple of minutes. So that could still be a factor in the later part of the race. But so far, the weather has been very, very good and very cooperative for all of the teams. So that's part of what's contributed to a lot of people having very, very fast races and going, in a lot of cases, faster than their schedules called for. Sometimes people going at paces that, if they can keep it up for the entire race, would be a record-setting pace. So we'll see if that starts to slow down a little bit in the last third of the race. But so far, a lot of these teams, including Brent and Allie Zirkel, both of the CVs, John Baker, Robert Sorley, Pete Kaiser, Noah Burmeister, are all looking very, their teams are looking very, very good, and they're having very fast and at least so far, relatively problem-free races.
Rounding out the field of mushers from 75th to 78th, we have Kristen Bacon in 75th, Billy Snodgrass, 76th, Mary Helwig in 77th, and Ellen Halverson, who we spoke about yesterday, is keeping up. She's with three other mushers currently on the trail on the way to Cripple, where Kristen is in Cripple and taking, it looks like, an extended break. We did have two scratches over the last 24 hours or so since we were on the air. We profiled Rick Casillo yesterday on our show. Unfortunately, he scratched due to injuries to his lead dogs. And that's very unfortunate to him, as well as the Mush and Mortician Scott Jansen scratched in Cripple, Rick scratched in Ruby. Any other information on those two guys before we move on?
Yeah, Rick said that his lead dog was bitten on the ankle when he was coming in by one of the other dogs on the team, and he didn't have any other dogs who were doing well enough in lead for him to continue, and he tried a couple of the other dogs and rested for a while before deciding to scratch, and ultimately just couldn't get a dog who was going to lead his team. So he had to scratch, and he said he was very disappointed for letting down the Warriors that he works with. You know, I feel a little bit bad that one of the things we said last time was that Rick was very proud of the fact that he had never had to drop out of a race that he had started. So I worry a little that we jinxed him. But on the other hand, also sometimes in a mission, and he likes to refer to his races and a lot of his camp activities as missions. Sometimes in a mission, you have to retreat a little before you can go forward and complete the mission. So I am preferring to think of it as a temporary retreat rather than anything else. And then Scott Jansen, the mushing mortician, his team was sick. They had whatever the bug is that's been going around, and so he scratched because his team was just not responding and not getting better as quickly as they'd like. For people who aren't as familiar with these sort of things in race conditions, that does not mean that it's a serious or life-threatening illness. It just means that the dogs aren't able to recover well enough so that they can go forward and be competitive in the next 24 or 48 hours, where they would need to be operating at a certain level of efficiency to continue the race.
And remember, guys, these sled dogs, they have to eat like monsters out there. And if they don't, it's going to be detrimental to the team very quickly. For these sled dogs, some of them are eating and processing up to 10,000 calories a day. And not only does that make them a very unique specimen of canine, but if the dog is sick, lethargic, has diarrhea, et cetera, the inability to be able to process that many calories in such a short amount of time will knock out a dog team quicker than anything. And as Alex had mentioned, it probably isn't something major. It's very possible that it's just your typical sled dog bug that goes through every checkpoint at just about any race that you raced in. We talked about this just the other day. I don't know how many times I've been racing my dogs, even short 30-milers, and they will all come back with a bit of a bug. It's just like, you know, kids in elementary school, all of them come back with colds and sniffles and the 24-hour flu and all that, very similar out there on the Iditarod Trail as well. So, Alex, let's jump into our story today. You know, I thought about the best way to cover this today, since we do have such limited time. We could probably carry on about this for a couple of hours, just going based on what everybody's talking about, everybody from Iditarod.com to the Alaska Dispatch News to some local reporters and the TV stations, and everybody has their take on it, their information that they're gathering. Let's first, if we can, for folks that may not know, I assume if you're listening to the show, you probably do, but let's do a very quick recap for folks that are just coming into this, I guess, a little bit blind. And then we'll add some commentary about it on what you and I think as a fan perspective, and I'll give my opinion as a musher's perspective, and then we'll kind of just see where it goes. How's that?
That sounds great. So the basic facts that we know at the moment are last night, overnight at around 2:30 in the morning, Ali Zirkel was coming into the Nalato checkpoint about 10 miles outside of Nalato, and a snow machiner who apparently was drunk attacked her team, or at least, let's put it this way, a snow machiner was on the trail and rammed into her sled, injured one of her sled dogs, and then apparently came back and seemed to be going after her again, deliberately attacking her three or four different times. She at one point picked up several of the trail markers and was fighting him off with the trail markers. And then several miles later, the same snow machiner apparently was close to her, revved the engine, seemed like he might come after her again, but did not. Shortly, a few hours later, this same snow machiner apparently hit Jeff King's dog team going at a very, very fast rate of speed. Jeff said it was possibly 80 miles per hour and killed Jeff's dog, Nash, injured another dog of his named Crosby, who I believe might have a broken leg. There were several other dogs on Jeff's team that were injured, including a dog named Banjo. And then the snow machiner just was gone. didn't turn around, didn't say anything. There were some early reports that Jeff may have been injured and sought medical assistance at the checkpoint, but that apparently was not correct. He said that he wasn't injured. Most of his dogs were not injured, but it was very, very close. And he said that it seemed like the snow machiner was trying to play chicken with him or intimidate him. And if he had been a couple of inches to the side from where he actually was, then he likely would have been struck and killed. And when he came into the checkpoint, he reported this. Allie had come in earlier and reported it as well. The injury to Allie's dog is not considered life-threatening, but it was enough that she dropped the dog. So that dog is on its way back to Anchorage. The race officials contacted the local village police and then the state police in Alaska. The snow machiner had the impact with Jeff's team caused the cowl, the sort of front part of the snow machine, to come off. So Jeff brought that back with him to the checkpoint, and they were able to use that to identify the snow machiner. Reportedly this morning, this individual woke up, heard about what had happened, and had said that he was very drunk at the time when he was out riding his snow machine, and did not remember if this had been him or not, but then went out and saw that his snow machine was damaged and called the village police and said that it was him. So I think that's the basics of what we know. Then the state police flew in, questioned the individual, and I believe he is now in custody.
Yes, he was flown to Fairbanks, is currently in the Fairbanks Correctional Center, where he will await there until charges have been formally filed. It looks like he's been charged with assault and criminal mischief at this point. He has not been charged up to this point with DUI or anything of the such, and nor has he been charged with animal cruelty. I believe, and again, I'm not home this week, but I believe that animal cruelty is just a civil issue up here in Alaska. I could be mistaken about that, but I don't believe that we have a criminal filing for animal cruelty, at least to my knowledge. Very quickly, before we get into some commentary, I would like to read a portion of what the Husky Homestead Tours posted on their Facebook page a couple of hours ago. Husky Homestead Tours is Jeff King's kennel operation. He runs tours up in the Denali Park area, and he trains up there along with a team of handlers and offers sled dog rides to the many tourists that come in and about, especially in the summertime. He has quite the operation up there. It says that he called and left a voice message there at the office, and he wanted to let everybody know that he was okay and the progress for Banjo and Crosby was good. He stated that it was a terribly sad event, but we will survive. And he also said that his thoughts go out to the community of Nualto and appreciate their support of us, Allie and her team, as well as the Iditarod and the Mushroom community. And then it goes on to say, it is easy for us to point fingers, but we would like to encourage forward and positive thinking in this situation. As Jeff said, quote, there are many wonderful people in these communities, and there have also been some very serious social issues in the rural communities around Alaska that involve substance abuse. I feel sorry for the communities that have to suffer through all that. I couldn't help but think of John Baker and Catherine Keith's attempt and many other wonderful people in rural Alaska's attempt to help provide role models that can put an end to the tragedy that goes along with substance abuse. And they would like to point out the website, AlaskansChangingTogether.org. I know that John Baker talked about this. It's called the ACT program. He talked about this at the Mushers banquet a couple of days before Iditarod, and you know, that this is something that he, as well as Governor Walker, are pushing along to try to get some positive changes out there in the community and make sure that, you know, things like this don't happen. As many people know, alcohol and substance abuse and domestic violence are real issues in the villages, as well as suicide. And I think that something has to be done. And, you know, being up here in Nome for the first time, it is so such a contrast being here compared to being in the quote-unquote big cities of Alaska. It's a, definitely a different way of life. I compare it very similar to when I was up in Barrow a few months ago. It's just such a stark reminder how far these folks are removed from the big city. I'm sure you saw that as well, Alex. What do you think? You know, you've traveled some in the villages of Alaska when you were up here. What can you, how can you give the sense of what these communities are like? And now Nome, granted, is a much bigger community than these rivers deeper in the interior. But what is your impression of life in these remote villages like Nome or other villages along the way?
Well, let me first start by saying that I am outside, so I am not an Alaskan and I do not live in the villages. So I'm not an expert on these things, and I'm a little bit reluctant to speak about them, but I'll give you my impression and the impression that I have from having talked to people, from having been in some of these places and talked to people who live in these villages. And basically, it can be very difficult. There is almost everything is insanely expensive in these villages. You posted a picture on Facebook from one of the markets in Nome where milk is $6.50 a gallon or something like that, and a 2-liter bottle of soda is over $4 over $4. Gasoline is very expensive. Almost everything has to be brought in either over the river by barge or flown into these areas. And as a result, it's very, very expensive. Now, you couple that with the fact that there is not generally a lot of industry or necessarily a lot of economic opportunity in many of these villages. And that's part of the reason that younger people have been abandoning villages, you know, not entirely, but a lot of younger people who are looking for more opportunity or more economic, choices will go to the larger cities. So you have a combination of not a lot of opportunity, some pretty serious poverty issues, and then over the past, my understanding is that over the past 40 or 50 years, as satellite television and cable television have been making their way into the interior, a lot of natives and a lot of people who have lived there for generations are sort of losing their heritage, and the kids see all of this stuff on television and they want all of the stuff that they see on television. And there's just not as much opportunity to be able to get and afford that stuff. There is also, my understanding is there is a very large problem in some of these remote villages with alcoholism, with substance abuse. Some of the villages, have decided to be dry, but then you have other villages which are not dry. My understanding also is that there is a fairly large liquor store that is near where these incidents took place. And we've seen in the past that there have been snow machine accidents. There was one in 2008 in which a dog was killed. that was relatively near the place where these incidents took place. So this is a big problem, and it has been a problem for some time. As I said, I'm not an expert in this. I don't have any easy solutions, and I think most people in Alaska also don't have any easy solutions, or else the problems would have been solved. There's a very interesting article by Craig Medred, who used to write for the Alaska Dispatch, and wrote a great, great book about back-of-the-pack Iditarod mushers called The Graveyard of Broken Dreams. And one of the things that he talked about in this article, which went up today on craigmedred.com, was that the Iditarod made a conscious decision in the villages to sort of corral the mushers and keep them separate from villagers. And one of the reasons they did that is that mushers who run the Iditarod a bunch of times would become friendly with villagers. When they came through the village, the villagers would take them home, would take care of them, and the mushers who were relatively new or hadn't made these relationships would then be at a competitive disadvantage. So the Iditarod decided that everyone would sort of be forced to stay in the same place and wouldn't be able to get an advantage from having a relationship with someone in the villages. And as a result of that, according to Craig, a lot of the remote villages started to resent the Iditarod, which would come through and fly people in and fly, you know, and these sled dog teams would come through who were sort of elite compared to the economic situation of the people who lived in the villages, and that there's been a sort of bubbling resentment from some of the villagers about the Iditarod and about the Iditarod teams. Now, we don't know that that's what motivated this to happen, and in fact, the suspect has said that he is very sorry for what happened and considers himself a big supporter of Iditarod. And certainly, a lot of the villagers in some of these remote areas are very involved with Iditarod and volunteer, and the kids all come out and cheer on the racers when they come through and make signs. But I think that is likely to be something that the Iditarod should be looking at.
You know, this individual, he comes from a family that is very close to mushing. I believe it is his uncle is an Iditarod veteran, and he has several other family members. His name is a relatively big name, at least in the mushing community. When you say that name, people sort of divert to who he is. And what I found very interesting, Alex, before we get into sort of the commentary from what Craig said and others said, first off, if you are listening live, make sure you listen to our episode in its entirety after we go off the air. You can find that at mushingradio.com. We'll also post a link over on Facebook on Dog Works Radio. Jeff was giving an interview there in Nualto, and right behind him was a sign. We talked about these folks having signs up in the villages. Was this gentleman's name on one of the signs? Did you get a chance to see that in the background?
You know, I saw that video, but I didn't notice it. I'll have to take a look again. But I will say that I've seen Jeff interviewed a whole bunch of times, and I've interviewed him a couple of times myself. This is a guy who is generally unflappable. This is a guy who is he may not love talking to the media as much as some mushers do, but this is a guy who's done that a lot. And I, watching him talking about what happened, he was so clearly shaken up and so clearly really rocked by what had happened this morning. And it really, you know, it just makes your heart go out to him. And I think anyone who's listening to this broadcast and anyone who's a fan of the Iditarod our hearts just go out to Jeff, to his dog Nash, and to Allie Zirkle and her team.
So what do you think? You know, the guy said in he posted an interview before he was arrested. He said that he was drunk, he had blacked out, that it wasn't intentional, you know, but for whatever reason, he kept coming back, not only to
right.
Allie, but then several miles later down the trail, he went after Jeff. And I find this the most incomprehensible thing I've ever heard. You know, at least in the mushing circles, and sort of my musher's take from this. I've been out on the Big Sioux River, the Yetna River, many times with snow machiners flying by at 100 miles an hour, and you know, a dog team out in a great expanse of a river is very difficult to see. And I don't know how many times I've come close to being hit by snow machines out there on the rivers. And thankfully, either my headlight—I flicked my headlight back and forth to catch the—you know—the sight of these guys. But these guys are going 100 miles an hour on, you know, a relatively flat surface, and you know, just like in a car, if you're going that fast, it's difficult to avoid obstacles. And thankfully, I've never been hit by one of these guys. But I don't know how many times I've been out there on the river where I've really white knuckled it. When I start to hear those snow machines in the distance. But this is a different case in its entirety. This is, from all accounts, it looks like a deliberate act. So first question to you, Alex, and then we'll get into the Craig Medred stuff, is do you think it was deliberate just from what you've read and heard? And then why do you think it was deliberate if it was?
You know, I agree with you that it's disturbing to me that he came back. I think the fact that he came back indicates that there was some conscious thought. If he was really blackout drunk, as he had claimed, you know, first of all, that's a problem in and of itself, and you know, it's 2016. We shouldn't have to say if you are drinking, you shouldn't be operating a motor vehicle. But apparently we still have to say that. But it bothers me that he came back. I find that very, very disturbing. I've talked to a bunch of people online today who have basically said that they don't care if he was drunk, that if he was drunk, he made the decision to drink. That is true. But if this is someone who seriously has an addiction problem, then that's a little bit more complicated. But yeah, it bothers me a lot that he came back.
It came back twice with two different teams.
Right.
So it appeared to me that he was singling them out for whatever reason. And I can only imagine if there were other teams in the crosshairs, so to speak. And I know that these two guys were guys and gals were relatively separated from the pack at that point. But of course, I would have to agree that alcohol was definitely a contributing factor, but I just don't know why, and I don't know if we'll ever know the motive behind it. But let's jump into the Craig Medred article, and you had mentioned craigmedred.com. It's actually craigmedred.news is his website, and he was a reporter for a long time with ADN and then ADN.com when they went to a more digital profile versus the newspaper itself. And as you mentioned, he is saying that it is more of, you know, a village problem with the disenfranchisement of the Iditarod taking itself away from the villages. And then it's sort of a, you know, bring everybody in and, you know, kind of, you know, just run wild for a couple of weeks and then just kind of pack up and go. And there's some resentment building there as things kind of dissipate down the trail. You know, I don't know if that resentment is there, but I definitely think that it is something that needs to be talked about, because it is. It's become a machine. It's become a corporate machine where they just sort of march down the trail and make their way from one end of the state to the other. And I don't know if they're leaving a lot of what the Iditarod was supposed to be sort of in the kind of back in history to the way that the Iditarod is today. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that last year when they had the different trail because of the start in Fairbanks and they went through Hooslea, a bunch of the longtime mushers such as Martin Boozer said that he really loved going through Hooslea because it was much more of a small village. It was much more of the type of area where the natives were really excited and the villagers were really excited about the Iditarod coming through. And several people reported that they had a much better time in some of these villages which weren't used to it than they traditionally would have in some of the villages where it comes through every year or every other year. So I do think that that's an interesting perspective. Joe May, who won the race, I believe, in 1980 and was on the ITC board for years, said that one year the village elders in Shaktulik said that they didn't want the race coming through at all. And they were saying, no, you have to reroute. You're not allowed to go through. And he said that he flew up there and he sat with the elders and he listened to their concern and he drank tea with them. And they told him what they needed and what they wanted. And he said, maybe what needs to be done is to have the ITC go to all of these villages and sit with the elders and drink tea and really find out what's going on and what their concerns are.
And I believe that Mark Nordman and the entire ITC crew has done a decent job of that. But I don't know, you know, it's like going to a city council meeting. You know, you're speaking to a group of folks that are the representatives of the community, but is the community truly heard in that forum? You know what I mean?
Right. Right. And, you know, we've said this many times, but Mark Nordman does not have an easy job. And I would have to imagine that today has probably been one of the worst and most challenging days that he has had professionally as race marshal for Iditarod.
So what do you think is going to come of this? Obviously, the young man has been charged and is in jail at this point. We unfortunately have a dog that's passed away. We have two racers there at the top of the leaderboard there that have been impacted by this. I know Allie is still in second, and Jeff is definitely in the top there. But what do you think is going to come of this in the immediate future? And then, in the grander scheme of things, I love what they were talking about there on the Husky Homestead Tours page on how we need to reflect on this and do something about, you know, the sort of social issues that are affecting our state, because I don't think it's going to go away kindly. Of course, it's not going to go away kindly, but it's definitely not going to go away. It's not something that you could sort of sweep under the rug and just kind of march on towards the next race. What do you think?
Right. All of those things are definitely true. Although it seems, at this point, it seems silly to even mention this, but last night it looked like Jeff King's team was bouncing back from his 24 so strongly that it seemed like him winning this race was a very real possibility. At this point, with the impact that he's had on his team, with the with the personal effect that this has had on him going forward, it is difficult to imagine that he is as competitive. But this is a guy who's run the race four times and nearly won it a couple of years ago. So certainly I wouldn't count him out. So that's the first thing, although it seems silly to talk about the competition in light of what happened. I am hopeful that this will open up a real dialogue about the conditions in these villages, not only economic conditions, but the conditions with regard to substance abuse and alcoholism, and really maybe have a more concentrated way of communicating to people that even if you are in the middle of nowhere, it's not okay to get drunk and get on the back of a snow machine. It's still a motor vehicle. It's still something that you have to drive and you have to control. There are a lot of, you know, in addition to dog teams on Iditarod, there's wildlife, there's other people, there's other snow machiners. And it feels to me like hopefully this will open up a real dialogue and get people more convinced that this is not a casual thing, that it is every bit as dangerous as, you know, being in Anchorage or being in Los Angeles and having eight beers and then getting behind the wheel. So I am hopeful that that will happen. As far as Iditarod, I think that there's going to be a lot of discussion about how to make the trail safer. I think there might be some additional staff at some of these checkpoints. Hopefully there will be more community outreach. I think that would help. I've heard a lot of discussion about today about mushers carrying guns, and that's kind of a whole other area and a whole other discussion. A lot of mushers carry small guns for, you know, in case of moose attacks or something like that. I can't imagine that this would, if a musher were ever to shoot someone, even someone who was attacking them on the trail, I can't imagine that would be anything less than catastrophic. Although I understand that mushers might feel like they were in danger and would need to be able to protect themselves. So I think a lot of these things are going to happen at the same time. And it's a long, long race. You can't post guards over 1,000 miles of trail that goes through these remote areas. So I am hopeful that they'll be able to figure out a way to make things a little bit safer and to encourage people, you know, in the villages and on the trail to be much more safe and to address some of these issues. But I'm not really sure what will happen.
You know, my opinion of this, Alex, resentment aside, if that was the motive, I don't think no matter what can be done in regards to community outreach or in the political arena, you know, as people always say, you cannot help people if they don't want to help themselves first. And, you know, the whole model behind addiction through AA and treatment programs, if you're not willing to accept help, there's not a lot that somebody can do for you. And I think with this rampant problem that we have in the villages of Alaska, in particular with substance abuse and alcohol abuse, I think it's going to be a very difficult hill to climb if people aren't willing to change. You know, people have been doing this for hundreds, if not thousands of years, have been living this particular lifestyle in these remote villages. And when they are used to a particular lifestyle, whether it does include substance abuse or not, when outside influences come in, as you mentioned, when the satellite televisions and all that came in and affected how the younger generations are seeing, you know, village life versus city life, And I think it's a real difficult hill to climb, and I think the true issue is, I know we're a quote-unquote mushing show or a sports show, but this is a social problem that I think needs to be addressed, and I don't think ITC is going to do it. I don't think it's going to be, you know, a government action. I think it will be something like what John Baker's proposing. But boy, what a system that would have to be in place to not only deal with the rampant poverty and you know, job loss and everything that goes on in these villages, to trying to include everybody as a whole. I don't think that can be done, or maybe we don't want it to be done. You know, we don't want to take away the village life, so to speak, and bring everybody up to standards of what everybody else expects or lives by. What do you think about that? But I have one other point about this, and then we can move on to our musher profile.
Yeah, the one other thing I wanted to mention is what people outside Alaska might not be aware of is Alaska is currently having a fairly severe budget problem brought on by a number of things, including the decline in the price of oil. A lot of the Alaska state money came from oil revenues, and when the price of oil falls, that falls significantly. So this is a challenging time in Alaska anyway, and I agree with you that it's probably not the time when a large, expensive government program could be launched easily.
Right. So my last question to you, Alex, and I guess we can comment on this a little bit, is what other folks in the mushing community are saying, not necessarily about you know, the death of the dog and you know, getting run over. Obviously, that is very tragic. But from folks that you follow, in particular Iditarod mushers that may not be running this year, or, you know, folks that are in the node, so to speak, what have you been hearing from what these folks are saying, and what can you comment on that?
Just generally, there is, first of all, just a feeling of complete shock and sadness. There have been other accidents involving racers or involving dogs in the past, but there has never been anything this serious or anything that seemed premeditated. And again, you know, we can't say whether or not it actually was premeditated, but it certainly seems that way because he came back several times for Allie, and then because he attacked Jeff King's team as well. So I'm hearing a lot of people are just absolutely devastated by this. There's a lot of outpouring of support for Jeff and for Allie. A lot of concern about the dogs, both the dog who was killed and the injured dogs. I've heard a little bit of, you know, people wanting vigilante justice and wanting to string this guy up, and I understand where that comes from, but mostly I've heard people trying to wrap their heads around this and trying to gather around and do whatever they can to make this better. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussion about it in the off season. It's very interesting to me that this happened on the year that they imposed the gag rule. So I wonder if that is going to have an effect on the people who are in the race now speaking out about it. But I am really hopeful that the ITC and the mushing community and, you know, the villages and the government will be able to start having a conversation about all of these issues. Like you said, it's not an easy problem to solve, but the first step is that we have to start talking about it.
And, you know, Alex, from a musher's perspective, about the the two teams continuing on with Allie and Jeff, wanting to continue to run the race. Not only is it a devastating event, you know, for this to happen, in particular your dog dying out on the trail, but a lot of folks have to understand that, you know, it's not just the 2 weeks out there on the trail. It's not, you know, just that 1,000 miles with your dogs. It's that 52 weeks of the year that we're spending with our dogs and spending time with them. And, you know, they have no idea that their sole purpose in life is to run the Iditarod. Their sole purpose in life is to run. And I find great comfort in them saying, you know what, we're going to continue on versus, you know, we're going to pull the plug, we're going to scratch, we're going to, you know, stop the race right here. Because it is a lifestyle, and they're doing it because that's what they're there for, not only the dogs, but the mushers. What is your response to that, Alex?
I could not agree with you more. And, you know, obviously, Allie and Jeff are very skilled and very competitive mushers who have very highly competitive and trained dog teams. And I believe that both of them still want to win, but I also believe that it is in some ways more important for them to continue and to be going forward with their dogs and making sure that their dogs are okay and bringing their dogs to Nome, that has probably become more important or moved more to the forefront in their minds than just winning a race.
Wow. So if you guys have any comments, questions, concerns, shoot us a line over on Facebook or Twitter. You can do it on our personal pages or on Dog Works Radio, both on Facebook and Twitter. Alex is at Coldfoot Films is where he's at on Twitter. Very active. They're using the hashtag #IditaChat right now throughout this race. So they're active pretty much 24 hours a day. As I mentioned the other day, I think they sleep less than the mushers do out on the trail. So if you do have comments about this, please pass that along. So we're going to switch gears here. I know we're well over time, but we do want to make sure that we carry our musher profile. That is a very important part of our show, and that's what a lot of people look forward to. But real quick, Alex, one comment in regards to Nome. You know, I came up here last night on a flight that was packed. It was absolutely packed. We stopped in Kotzebue and then flew on into Nome. But I don't see a lot of fans here yet. I know we're still 3 or 4 days out, but this, it doesn't have the Iditarod vibe, if you know what I mean. When did you come to Nome? At what portion of the race? I know you were here for some of the finishers, but were you here a couple of days in advance? And what kind of vibe did you feel about Nome when you were here?
No, I came late, so I came after the winter had come in. But then I came for the last, I think, 4 or 5 or 6 finishers, and was here for the finishers banquet, and there was very much an Iditarod vibe when I was there. I think it sort of reaches its peak when the winter comes in because then there are thousands of people on Front Street as opposed to, you know, a few hundred or a few dozen when some of the later finishers come in. But there was very much a party atmosphere. The bars are very, very busy and active, and you know, the restaurants are always crowded, and people are, it's a relatively small downtown area, so if you just walk around the streets, you tend to run into a lot of fans and volunteers. So I got a pretty full sense of it. I think you're still there a little bit early. So my guess is that people are going to start flooding in, early next week, Monday or Tuesday.
Right. You know, I was walking down to the finish line last night, and then I had to grab pizza. I have to eat pizza in every new town that I'm in. I went to the airport pizza there sort of in, offside of town there. And, you know, I only passed one person on the road on the way to I'm at the Aurora Inn, which is a little further down from the finish. So definitely nobody here yet. I'm interested to see when the throngs of people will show up and then, of course, how that sort of changes things as we build up towards the winter. I do think it will probably be, as it typically is, sometime late on Monday, early Tuesday, when we'll see a finisher. Who that is at this point, we have no idea. There's still over a third of the race to go, and all of us are rooting for not only our favorite mushers, but for everybody out there on the trail, all the way from Brent to Ellen, at least from the last time I checked, 78 teams still out there on the trail. So, Alex, let's jump into this relatively quickly tonight. We've talked about Monica Zappa quite a few times. She, I believe, is the only guest that has been on my show three times. She's been on this show three times over the last few years. Yes, she was on before her rookie run. She was on shortly thereafter. Then I believe in between her second and third run, so sometime in about a year and a half ago. She is the only person that's been on three times. So if you'd like to hear those episodes, you can find them on mushroomradio.com. Just search for Monica Zappa in the search bar. And, you know, what do you think? What do you know about Monica? She's got quite the family history, doesn't she?
Yeah, she is, and she's one of the more colorful and compelling sort of up-and-coming Iditarod racers. She grew up in Wisconsin. Her parents were mushers, so she's been around dogs for most of her life. She got a BA in meteorology, a master's degree in geography. So another one of these racers who has multiple degrees. Her father had always dreamed of running the Iditarod, but wasn't able to do it. And then her father died, I believe, when she was a teenager, and they had to give up most of their dogs. So she spent about 10 years being away from dogs. In 2011, she was going to grad school and decided that she wanted a change of pace, wanted to try mushing again and see how that was for her. So she went back up to Alaska, to Kisilov. She hooked up with Tim Osmer, who's comes from a very long line of mushers as well, became kennel partners with him. They live off the grid in the Caribou Hills area in the Kenai. They have a kennel that now has, I believe, about 50 dogs. She is always wearing a very colorful green parka. That's sort of her trademark. And one of the things that she does is she is mushing for clean water and wild salmon. So if you see her, she's always got the clean water and wild salmon flag with the no pebble mine sign on it. The pebble mine, for people who don't know, is a proposed copper mine that would have that would drain into one of the largest Clearwater salmon runs in the world. And she has been fighting against that. She works during the off season. She does tours and also is a commercial fisherman. So salmon and fish and fresh water is something very important to her. She feels that Bristol Bay is a very sacred place for salmon, and it's some place that needs to be protected. It's very hard if an area like that becomes polluted to ever really clean it up. So she has been mushing to raise awareness about that. She posts a lot of great videos on Facebook and on her website. One of her sponsors is Prodrenaline, which is a software company that makes stabilization software for GoPro cameras. So you can run that on your GoPro footage, and it comes out looking much, much smoother and nicer. And they've been using a lot of footage of her team to advertise their product. and that's a very cool sponsorship that she has there. She also, this year, started making red, white, and blue paw print bracelets from twine, that the nylon twine they use to fix fishing nets for their commercial fishing. And these are all handmade by Monica herself, and she guarantees that if you buy one of these bracelets, if it breaks, she will either repair it or replace it personally, which is kind of a cool thing because unlike, you know, buying a shirt or something from a team, you're actually having something that has been touched and made by the person you're supporting. She does a lot of stuff with schools and school outreach during Iditarod and in the preparation for Iditarod. And this year she had a bunch of dog blankets made for her team that were sent to her by various schools and kids all around the country. So she has a lot of pictures of that on her website and up on her Facebook, which is really cool. And just before the Iditarod started, she very prominently posed with a Bernie Sanders sign, so she wasn't sure if it would be allowed to make that kind of political statement, but saw that other mushers had had been supporting Lisa Murkowski, the U.S. Senator from Alaska, so she decided that it was okay for her to endorse Bernie Sanders. And just a very colorful, well-spoken, really fun musher who always has interesting and cool things to say.
Her website is teamzappa.com. What is behind? I'm sure a lot of people have heard that name before, the Zappa name. Where does that come from?
Yeah, she's been asked a lot of times if she's related to Frank Zappa, the musician, and she said that she is a distant relative of his. One of her lead dogs, who unfortunately is not with her on Iditarod this time, is named Dweezil, which is the name of Frank Zappa's son. So there aren't that many Zappas in the country. So it makes sense that she is related to him, even if it's not a very close relation.
Right. So looking forward to her doing very well out on the trail. As we mentioned, she is partners with, and I believe they're a couple, Tim Osmar, from a very long line of mushers. Has he ever won the race, Alex? I know his brother has.
I don't believe he's ever won, but I am pretty sure that he's had top 10 finishes. But in any event, he's run the Iditarod multiple times, not in the past few years, but the last time, I believe the last time he ran, he was running with Rachel Scuderis, who is legally blind, and he was the musher who was running sort of in tandem with her to help her down the trail.
So definitely check out her website. You'll see a very famous dog on there. His name is Menelix, I believe is how you pronounce it. I remember running with Monica several years ago in the Goose Bay 150, and I remember this little dog, Menelix, I believe is how you pronounce it again. He is a very interesting looking Alaskan Husky. He has these very piercing blue eyes with a very rust-colored fur. You can't miss him if you're watching Monica coming in to the checkpoints. I remember I was mushing in that Goose Bay 150, and we were running together. Monica Zappa, Lisbeth Norris, and I got off the trail by several miles, and we were lost for quite a ways, and I remember parking on the side of the trail and having a little bit of a picnic while it cooled down on the trail, and we sort of mushed into the finish together. Of course, I was bringing up the Red Lantern position because my dogs were slower than theirs, but we got to spend quite a bit of time out there on the trail with Monica and Lisbeth. Those two gals have been friends for quite a long time. I know it was, their rookie year of running Iditarod. They pretty much ran most of the race together and finished within a couple of minutes of each other. And they're still pretty close friends. You will see lots of pictures of those two ladies together posing as the up-and-coming women of mushing. And I think that's a pretty cool thing. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And both of them, you know, both of them very, very willing to give interviews. They're both very well spoken, and it's always fun to listen to them either together or separately.
All right, Alex, we are an hour and 5 minutes on our half-hour show, so I'm sure that the folks over there at KVRF who are getting our daily shows are probably going to be pulling their hair out when I send them over this episode here in a few minutes. But we can't leave without talking about what we're going to mention tomorrow. As we said, this has been a real difficult day for not only the Iditarod, but for the fans and, of course, the mushers out on the trail. We just hope that things proceed as planned and the race goes smoothly for the rest of the race. We still have a whole lot of racing to do. The banquet isn't until next Saturday night, I believe, so we have at least another week on the air here, and I hope we can continue on our daily coverage. We're getting lots of comments and high fives from people all over the world, people saying great stuff from our show. So that's what encourages us. I know, Alex, you see quite a bit of those as well, so I hope that we can continue on at least through the banquet as we normally do. So what are we talking about tomorrow? Do you have a story, and do you have a musher?
So tomorrow I want to talk about Larry Daugherty as our musher of the day, who is an interesting guy, and we'll learn a lot more about him tomorrow. It's his rookie run.
Very good.
He's towards the end of the pack, towards the back of the pack, but I think people will be interested in a lot of things about him.
You know, he started out with Jim Lanier's kennel a couple of years ago, and I believe he's running with the CV teams now. So he has definitely got himself a pretty good dog team behind him. Currently, he is in 73rd place. He's back there with that rookie pack that we talked about yesterday with Elliot Anderson, Patrick Beal, Kim Franklin, Kristen Bacon, and Mary Helwig, all rookies there on the trail or in Cripple. So they're making their way. They're well past the halfway point at this point and making their way and doing very well, considering he and Patrick were lost for about a half a day there in between the second and third checkpoint, weren't they?
Right, right.
So very good. Alex, unless you have something else, thank you very much for staying over today. I wanted to make sure we got the story from how we saw it. You know, we started talking back and forth at about 7 o'clock this morning over text when I woke up and saw it, and then we sort of figured out how we were going to best lay it out. I thought we did a decent job covering at least all the points that we read about today and sort of our own opinion. So thank you very much for sharing your insight, and we'll make sure that we talk again tomorrow. How's that?
Sounds great. Thanks, Robert.
Very good. So on behalf of my co-host today, Alex Stein, we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.